From China to America to Europe, energy prices are spiking and supply shortages are breaking out. What's causing these crises and how much worse are things likely to get from here? To find out, we went straight to an energy industry expert for answers.
This is a shortage born out of bad planning, inappropriate expectations, and bad luck, if you will.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Adam Taggart, founder of Wealthion, welcoming you back for another week of making sense of money and the markets so that you can make better informed decisions about building your wealth. Now, energy is suddenly headline news. Oil, which traded at negative prices for a brief moment last year due to the economic global slowdown caused by the pandemic, is now expected by a growing number of analysts to hit $100 a barrel soon. Europe is worried about not having enough natural gas to heat its homes this winter. A petrol shortage in the UK is making it a challenge for folks there to fill their cars. And prices at the pump are back near record highs in the US. Also, China and India are so short on coal that major metropolitan power plants are resorting to rolling blackouts to conserve fuel. Why are so many regions of the world suddenly experiencing these energy crises? Petroleum geologist and energy analyst Art Berman has a lot of the answers we're looking for, and I'm so pleased he was able to join us today on such short notice. Art, it's wonderful to see you again. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Likewise, Adam. Always good to talk to you. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, you're more than welcome. And look, we got a lot to dig into today. But as we start, let me just ask you a very high-level question. What is your current assessment of world energy markets today? And how do you expect them to impact both the global economy and the financial markets going forward?
Well, there's a lot in that question, as I know you understand, Adam. So to make it as simple as I can, the first thing that is happening and will continue to happen, which, you know, doesn't take an advanced degree, is that with energy prices being where they are and where they're going, we can expect inflation to increase, which is not exactly where we want to be as far as a global economic recovery goes, because obviously inflation at some point will slow economic activity. At some point, it will affect demand for oil, natural gas, coal, electricity, all of those things. So there's a lot of people who are kind of celebrating the fact that, well, we finally have energy prices kind of back where some people think they need to be. And I'm rolling my eyes and saying, is that really what you want, guys? So, you know, I think that's the takeaway that most people should understand, and that, as you and I have discussed before the program, the correlation between inflation and oil price is scary. I mean, it's just an awfully, awfully good correlation, particularly over the last 20 years or so. So, and that I know that doesn't surprise you, Adam. It may surprise some people that spend too much time listening to economists, but I mean, oil's the master resource. Price of energy goes up. Energy is the economy. It affects the cost of everything. So my expectation as to where energy markets are taking us right now is, if we're lucky, it will be a wake-up call. And the wake-up call will be that in our enthusiasm to get into an energy transition, to renewables and all of that, and let me be 100% upfront, I'm all for it. I'm 100% for all of that. I'm not a partisan just because I've spent most of my career in the oil and gas business. But I mean, you can't just abandon investment in your primary source of energy, which, like it or not, is fossil energy, coal, natural gas, and oil. And a lot of people or a lot of countries have been pretending that somehow we can do that. And this energy crisis, while it has many, many causes that are complex. Fundamentally, what it's telling us is that renewable energy is not quite ready for prime time, at least as our principal source or even a leading source of energy. And that's not what anybody wants to hear, but that is the truth. And I'm not here to say that renewable energy is the cause of this crisis, but it's certainly a leading cause. So I hope that's a somewhat complete answer.
All right. Well, it's certainly a great jumping off point into today's discussion. And I actually want to bang through all of those different topics with you. Rising prices, tightening supplies right now, the impact that the move to alternative energy sources is playing in the current crunch that we're in. Two visuals. One, I put one up while you were talking earlier, Art, showing the correlation of oil prices and inflation, which you sent over to me. And yes, that does have a very, very high R squared. And folks, basically, R squared just means it measures the correlation between the data. And the data that Art was referencing there just said that, look, when oil prices go up, inflation go up, or vice versa, because they're so tightly correlated. I want to put up another chart right here, which basically is just world GDP compared to overall energy consumption in BTUs. This measures it from 1969 to 2013. This was put together by Gelt Verberg, who was an actuary. But it basically shows you that the correlation is, as Art said, you know, oil and energy is the master resource. You don't have energy if you don't have, you don't have an economy if you don't have energy. This data set proves it. The correlation here, the R squared factor, is 0.99. And of course, a perfect correlation is one. This is why we need to care about energy, folks, because if we have crises in energy, it's very highly likely those are going to lead to economic crises as well, given how tightly tied they are. All right. Well, so jumping off here, Art, I mentioned in the intro here that we're seeing both prices spike across most of the major fossil fuels right now, oil, natural gas, coal, and we're seeing concerning shortages in a number of places around the world. Can you just sort of talk about the moves that we've seen both on the price side and you know, what you think is sort of responsible right now? Because, you know, there's some knock-on effects here where there's shortages of one fossil fuel that's then creating heightened demand for another form, and then that's overwhelming the supply. So can you just sort of break down for us exactly what's happening across the world right now as we hear about, you know, issues from China to India to the UK to Germany to really almost everywhere?
Well, first of all, let me say that we're not running out of anything. We're not even close to running out of any fossil fuel or any renewable. And so this is a shortage born out of bad planning, inappropriate expectations, and bad luck, if you will. And so we say shortage, what we're really talking about is we just don't have the supply that's needed in one place in the place where it's needed. And more broadly, this is true for just about anything that you want to buy in the world right now. My daughter and son-in-law just came back from a couple of years in France. They were working over there. They need to buy some cars. And you know, it's really hard to get a car. Why? Because the chips are in short supply. That doesn't mean there aren't enough chips in the world. It just means that they can't get the chips in the cars on the ships to get them to where my son-in-law and daughter want to buy them in the amount of time in which they need them. There's plenty of cars, there's plenty of chips, but there's this so-called supply chain issue, which is affecting everything. And you'll hear a zillion explanations for it. And the most common is, oh, well, it's COVID. You know, I mean, COVID came and killed demand for a lot of things, including cars, including rental cars. And now all of a sudden demand seems to be back, thanks largely to the giveaway programs of central banks and federal governments. But that's another story altogether. And suddenly it, you know, it's difficult to rebuild those supplies. That's altogether true. But to say that that's the cause is, I think, misleading, because it suggests that, well, all we need to do is solve us a little problem like COVID. Not so easy, but relatively easier than some other things. You know, this is going to go away. Well, the problem is that it's really a crisis of shipping when you get right down to it. Okay, it's not so much the products that we want, and this, by the way, includes coal and gas and oil and all that other stuff, but there's a shortage of ships, not because there aren't enough ships, but because they can't get into ports. And so I'm sure everybody's heard that there's, I don't know, 50 some odd container ships that are stuck off the port of Los Angeles, can't get in. Why can't they get in? Because there aren't enough people to unload the ships and not enough truck drivers to offload the products and take them away. And so we've got, you know, huge amounts of ships that are just sitting around doing nothing. Well, that means there aren't enough ships to go back to where they came from to fill up again. And so there's a major bottleneck. And of course, when that happens, the cost of shipping goes up, because, you know, demand, supply, and all of that. And so the cost of container shipping is up about sevenfold since the beginning of the year. So people want to know, why does everything cost so much? Well, if the cost of sending it somewhere went up by 7x, hopefully the cost of getting it isn't 7x, but it's more. So there's all these kind of, you know, I guess you'd say unanticipated outcomes, because we live in this hugely complexified world. And I think complexify is the word I want to use. And so as we increase the complexity of our lives, we globalize the economy, and that didn't happen yesterday, we're vulnerable to, when things are not working at 100%, then everything breaks down, basically. And so my sense is that we'll get, you know, things will get better, but until the next thing happens. My fear is that if we say it's all because of COVID, well, then we're not really paying attention to what's happening. COVID exposed these problems. It didn't create them.
Right. To use, and I hate to make this a medical analogy, but to use an analogy, if we just assume it's COVID, then we're sort of treating the symptom and not the root disease, correct?
Exactly. Yes.
All right. So the current issues that we're having are largely due to supply, but really, sorry, maybe more to distribution. So we just can't get what's needed where it's needed most at the time it's needed most right now. And I hear you saying that this is, you know, multifactorial, but really kind of at the base lies our highly efficient and perfect times, but unresilient global supply chains. And right now, you know, basically someone's throwing a big monkey wrench into them, and it's having ripple effects across the world. Real quick, can you just sort of give us a sense as to how the price of the major energy sources has gone up? I think oil today just crested above $80 a barrel. I know that gas and coal have seen big jumps. What's just sort of the magnitude of the increase we're seeing right now in the actual root energy commodities themselves?
Yeah, I mean, use a number like, you know, 40-50% from, you know, year over year. So, I mean, it varies, of course, from commodity to commodity, but and where you measure it. But I mean, it's a big jump. So, I mean, let's take oil. I mean, oil was, you know, let's just say $40-$50 a barrel a year ago. And now you just said it's 80. That's WTI US oil. Brent is a little bit higher. Big jump. Natural gas a year ago in the U.S. was, you know, maybe $2, maybe $2.25 per million BTUs. Today, it's pretty close to $6. So that's an even bigger jump. And coal is kind of similar. So, you know, we're seeing big increases. And some of these are, I guess what you'd say, you know, they're organic. So the price of natural gas in the United States, which is a, you know, kind of an insular market, it's North America, We've gone from something like $2 or $2.50 to $6. That doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in Europe, particularly. What it does have to do with is the U.S. has become a big exporter of natural gas. And during COVID, there weren't a lot of orders for LNG. And so we had this this buffering effect or this muting effect where we didn't really have a lot of demand a year ago. But now that that's over, I mean, we're exporting something like 10 or 12 BCF a day. We produce something like 90. So you know, we have another 10 or 15% added into demand, which just simply didn't exist 3 or 4 years ago. And you don't add a big chunk of new demand without having it affect price. So that's the reason in the United States. In Europe, which is really where the core of the crisis began, the problem in Europe is that they have very aggressively and enthusiastically gone into mostly wind as a major source of electric power. And that's to the good, to my way of thinking. But because of the weather patterns, typically when there's high pressure, which happens either when it's cold or when it's hot, the wind doesn't blow very much. And Europe depends, places like Germany, 20, 25% of their electric power comes from wind, and the wind hadn't been blowing. So all of a sudden, you're down 20, 25%. Well, what are you going to do to make it up? Well, they had a cold winter, so their stockpiles or their inventory of coal's down. They can't really rely on that. You don't just, you know, get online and order natural gas from Amazon and it, you know, it shows up tomorrow. It's out there, but, you know, but when will it get here? And the answer is not this winter. It's not going to get here. So, again, I don't want to blame, green energy for the problem, but it is a part of the problem, certainly. And the same thing happened in Texas this winter. We had a big freeze. And everybody said, oh, well, you know, it had a lot to do with the natural gas. The wells were freezing, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the truth is that the wind stopped blowing about 2 weeks before the storm arrived. And so we were screwed before the cold weather even got here just because of a natural cycle of not a lot of wind. So this is one of the downsides of renewable energy that we have to look at. And the world has been, as the world often does, saying, okay, well, you know, we understand those issues, but we don't think they're big issues. Okay, well, all of a sudden they are.
Yeah, and I think this is really fascinating. And I think you're supplying an important part of the puzzle here that at least I haven't seen sussed out so much kind of in the regular media so far, the major media headlines. And maybe I'm just reading the wrong ones. But, you know, I think you've said, you know, Art, and I'm just like you, you know, I cheer the transition of weaning ourselves off the addiction that our global economy has on fossil fuels. But we're not going to get there overnight. And, you can cheer the people who are really trying to accelerate the process. But I think what you're saying is you got to be realistic about it, right? And it seems here, you know, certain countries, at least, maybe sort of, you know, we're over their skis a little bit in terms of the pace of their transition, where, you know, you said Germany increased its dependency on wind for its electrical grid up to 25% of its supply, but it didn't have a good backup in place if the winds, you know, went into a lull period, which it seems like they did. And because of that, you begin to have this knock-on effect. And I've talked about this a couple of times in past videos, where you have this thing called the bullwhip effect, where you get one variation that then causes players to start to react in more of a knee-jerk way, which then causes even bigger variations, and it kind of begins to cascade throughout the system. Can you talk a little bit about China's role in here too? Because I understand that what's exacerbated the situation is that China used to get a lot of its coal from Australia, but for some political reason, it switched from buying Chinese coal. It didn't want to buy. It decided, you know, for political reasons, not to buy Australian coal, and so it had to go elsewhere on the coal market to buy the coal it needed. And that basically began stealing supply from other big economies like India and others. And then once Europe got short and started demanding more coal, all of a sudden there's just much less coal available for, you know, everybody that needs it badly right now. So can you sort of talk about how this bullwhip effect begins to just, you know, propagate through the system, making it worse?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things going on here. Coal, I mean, nobody wants to talk about coal. I mean, coal is dirty and ugly and all this kind of stuff. And I'm not, you know, I'm reflecting public opinion. I'm not saying anything bad about the coal industry. But the truth is that places like Europe, even, that think they're especially green, have been using an awful lot of coal for many years. And case in point was, I hate to be picking on Germany, but they're easy to pick on here, when after the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan, the people of Germany pretty much voted to shut down all their nuclear power generation. And so what did they go to? Well, they went to coal. So the same country that is the most aggressive in their switch to wind is also relying more heavily on coal. And nobody in Europe wants to acknowledge their dependency, their absolute dependency on Russia for natural gas. And I don't want to, I don't want to wade into that debate except to say that it's palpable, except what are you going to do? I mean, Russia's got a ton of gas, and Russia has just completed a pipeline under the Baltic called the Nord Stream 2, which will begin to deliver about 5.5 billion cubic feet a day sometime very soon. That's a lot, but it's sort of a drop in the bucket compared to the 140, 150 BCF a day that the EU uses. It'll help, but it isn't going to solve the problem. So basically, Europe has done an objectively horrible job of planning. It has not really acknowledged its need for energy security. Now, flip over to a place like Asia, where they're most of these big economies, certainly Japan and Korea, they don't have squat for natural resources for energy. They don't have any gas. They don't have any oil. And so they're super, super sensitive to energy security. And they will do whatever it takes ahead of time to guarantee that they have whatever it takes, whether it's, you know, LNG, whether it's coal, whatever. And so Europe is, you know, got kind of, you know, they got caught with their energy pants down. And so China, to go back to your point, China decided it didn't want to buy any more coal from Australia, which to me seems like an incredibly ill-informed choice or decision. But I think it reasoned, well, we can get it from somewhere else. We can get it from Indonesia, which indeed they could. And apparently Indonesia's had inundating rains. And so Indonesia has not really been able to deliver what China hoped it would. So it, you know, pushed its friends in Mongolia to make more, and they're not doing so great with that. And like you said, that, you know, that basically takes coal supply from other people. Asians, including China, are outbidding Europeans for LNG, liquefied natural gas, because they pay attention to energy security. By the way, you have to have terminals to receive the LNG. Places like Germany have almost none. So, I mean, it's not a matter, again, of, you know, phoning up Amazon or eBay and saying, send me some LNG. They're going to say, well, you know, you have a facility where we can land a ship and you can take it off and you can degas it and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's complicating, but it's the bullwhip effect that you're talking about, that suddenly, you know, everybody's scrambling for the same thing and nobody has as much as they want today. Now, having said that, I mean, all of these shortages are ultimately temporary. I mean, they will, I mean, they, as I said in the beginning, we're not running out of any of the natural resources. It's just a matter of distributing them. Having said that, I can't begin to tell you when the situation normalizes.
All right, too bad, because that was my next question for you. But maybe can I ask you not to predict a month, you know, but just sort of a ballpark, you know, would you be surprised if this hadn't equilibrated by, say, spring?
Well, you know, I'm going to answer you the standard scientist answer, which is it depends. Yeah. I would hope that we would be in a better place than we are today by spring. I would sincerely hope so. I mean, I think, you know, let's look at the master resource for a second, oil. I mean, the price of oil is high right now for a couple of reasons. Number one is this, you know, terrible hurricane that we had in the Gulf of Mexico in late August. That did more damage to production platforms, pipelines, processing facilities than any hurricane in, you know, something like 20 years. So, and we're still, you know, here a month and a half later, we're still something like 250,000 barrels a day of oil production that hasn't come back. So that put a lot of pressure on the global market right there. And then all this energy crisis in Europe and elsewhere sort of compounded that. At the same time, OPEC Plus recently said, we're not going to increase supply any more than we said, and that's what kicked it over the top. So OPEC Plus said we're just going to stick to the schedule, and that's what really caused the latest jump in price. Actually, prices were coming down. Prices were going down to, you know, where I could see them, you know, maybe stabilizing in the 60s or something, but that got a frenzy going. And once there's a perception of undersupply, markets get scared. And so there's just an awful lot of compounding factors right now, and I don't know how those will play out.
Okay. Reading your most recent newsletter, which folks, by the way, we'll talk about at the end of this video, but Art's going to make available to folks watching this video for free. You talk about kind of the breathless headlines right now about oil going to 100 and above, perhaps. If I'm reading it correctly, it sounds like you're looking at those with a skeptical eye. Can you just sort of opine on that briefly?
Well, I am, Adam, and I just got done saying that markets get very insecure when they sense that there's not enough supply. But having said that, looking at where prices should be relative to global inventories, markets are still discounting the price of oil, if you can believe that. They're discounting the price of oil a good $5 to $10 a barrel below what inventory levels suggest they should be. Why is that? Because markets are smart and markets are cheap. Markets hate to overpay. So we got OPEC alone is sitting on something like 7 million barrels a day of spare capacity. That's EIA's estimate. Some people will argue with that. Some people say they don't know what they're talking about. I don't really care. It's a lot of oil. You know, is it 5 million? Is it 7 million? Is it 9 million? It doesn't matter. OPEC Plus has more because they include Russia. Those guys could solve this problem tomorrow, maybe, if they wanted to, but they don't want to. And I don't blame them. They took a lot of hits, a lot of economic losses to get the market to where it is right now, prices where they are, and they want to benefit from it just like any business. So I'm not blaming them, but I'm just saying that the market knows that there is a fair amount of spare capacity out there. The market knows that the United States, its production hasn't dropped as much as some people like I thought it would. And we can talk about that if you like to. Sometimes I'm wrong. You know, I guess I'm wrong. You know, everybody's wrong some of the time. I missed that when I called it wrong. But you know, there's a lot more stability in the U.S. production level than certainly I anticipated. And it's going to grow with higher prices. That is inevitable. It may not grow as fast as we need it to. But my point is that people are freaking out about undersupply. Markets, not so much. Markets are saying, well, yeah, we need to get more drilling done. We need to get prices up some, but I don't think markets are buying into $100. Why aren't they? Well, they're cheap. So companies tell the markets, tell investors, tell the Dallas Fed that they're making, oil companies are making a profit at $50 a barrel. All right. So if they're not drilling enough wells at $80 a barrel, then what will be the effect of giving them 90 or giving them 100? If they're not drilling enough, if they're making 30 bucks a barrel and they're not motivated to drill wells, do you really think they're going to drill a whole lot more wells if you increase the price? I mean, we can argue about whether you think that'll happen, but markets are saying, no, we don't really think that's going to happen. The other thing, of course, is inflation. And we started out talking about that. And so, you know, inflation in the United States is, I don't know, it's probably 5% right now or something like that, 4 point something. That's a lot higher than it has been. And at some point, you know, there's going to be a slowing of economic activity. I mean, this global crisis and the shipping crisis, I mean, the knock-on effects from that, I think, are beyond what most people imagine. Don't let me get out of here without talking about Evergrande and some of the financial problems going on in China. Those, you know, people, the press says, oh, well, don't worry about it. That's confined to China. Don't for a minute think that the knock-on effects of that will be anything other than deflationary for the world, big time. So, you know, on the one hand, yeah, all the momentum right now seems up, but there's an awful, I guess to be perfectly honest and objective, I see as many downside risks right now as I do upside risks for price of oil and other commodities. The price is only going to stay high and growing as long as people can afford to buy them. And let's not forget, I mean, we've just a year ago or so had the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. It doesn't go away with, you know, with the waving of a magic wand by the Federal Reserve Board. I mean, there's still a lot of people out of work. There's still a lot of businesses that are, I mean, we have a fragile economy, is my point.
Okay. Great description of a very complex system, Art. And I really do appreciate you packing so much of the picture into, you know, such a concise answer. I know it's not easy. All right. So here's sort of where I'm going with this. People who are watching, the whole reason behind these videos is to try to help people understand sort of what's coming down the road as best we can. Where is the puck going? And I'm going to put some words in your mouth and then you correct me if I'm wrong here, but you're saying, look, distribution is tight right now, which is forcing the price of these major energy commodities up. It's causing this sort of freak out factor that you're talking about. I think you would say that people are maybe freaking out more than is warranted. And I'm not trying to diminish in any way somebody who might be sitting in a cold home this weekend that can't get enough, you know, fuel to stay warm. That's a whole separate other element we haven't even talked about, which is just sort of the human cost of an energy crisis. But what I hear from you is sort of like, look, this is going to work its way through. It's not that we don't have enough coal or oil or natural gas in the world. It's just they're bottlenecks right now, and we're going to have to sort of work through them. So you expect sort of prices to moderate, the supply squeezes to moderate, hopefully, we talk about maybe by next spring. So that's the short term. But with sort of the longer march, and you and I in past years have had discussions around peak oil and, just sort of overall energy supplies, given the way the global economy is growing and wants to continue to grow. How concerned are you in the long run? So let's not talk 6 months. Let's talk the next decade, the next, you know, 4 decades. What role will, energy supply, like fundamental energy supply, or resource scarcity, I guess, in the energy space play, where just the economy may want to grow faster than we have economic oil or economic, you know, other energy forms to fuel? Is that a big concern of yours, a small concern? Where is it?
It's a big concern. And the first thing that bothers me a lot is the notion of drain America first. You know, we were a country until the 1970s, early 70s, that was super conscious of maintaining our own spare capacity. I mean, we were the biggest oil producer in the world. We produced, you know, something like 55% of the world's oil just after World War II. So, I mean, we were OPEC times two. And the U.S. controlled the price of oil through a system which was called allowables. If you drilled a well, you were not allowed to produce more than you were told you could. And the reasons for that were twofold. One, to keep world prices low. And the other was to make sure we had enough supply in the United States for our own security reasons. That went out the window when U.S. production started to decline around 1970. And that's about the time that OPEC's ascendancy began. And so, but we very quickly learned that we could get screwed big time by OPEC deciding to embargo us with oil. So we banned the export of crude oil. And that ban came off at the end of 2016. And today we're still exporting, you know, 3.5 million barrels a day. And so the idea of draining America first, while it's kind of patriotic and chest beating, you know, that, oh, look how big we are and how strong we are. It's really not a very smart idea from a long-term perspective. The bigger issue, Adam, is that Jeff Currie, who's the head of commodities for Goldman Sachs, when he's not pitching his book, which he does a lot of the time, and I understand that, he's really a very good mega thinker. And he talked in a recent interview about what he calls the revenge of the old economy. And so he says, look, you know, you've got an old economy that's based on metals and oil and gas and, you know, all kinds of mining and all of that. And then you got this new economy. It's a new economy. It's based on renewables and technology and all this kind of stuff. And so we've made this psychological shift to the new economy, and we've underfunded, he says, starved the old economy, industries like oil, like gas. And now that economy is getting its revenge. It's saying, okay, see, you ignored us. Look what happens when you ignore us. And the simple matter is basically another factor that I didn't mention as to why markets are discounting the price of oil is because investors are shorting oil. They're saying, look, you know, we think there's only 5 or 10 years more demand for oil. I think that's absurd, but that's kind of the mindset we're in. And if that's what investors think, well, then that's the reason that energy overall is something like 2.4% of S&P 500 market cap. You can't take the main, I mean, fossil energy is 79% of our total supply. And at least in terms of market cap, you're giving it 2%. You know, how's that working for you? I mean, that cannot work very long term. And so, yeah, I think we're going to be using some amount, a very large amount of oil and gas for certainly the rest of my life, the next several decades. And if we're going to get caught like Europe just got caught, if we're not mindful of that. And until we figure out a way to store electric power, which we're a long way from, at least on any kind of commercial scale, I mean, the hard truth is that renewable energy is not ready for prime time. We cannot. I mean, you know, you mentioned that Germany relies on wind for 20-25% of its electric power. I think I said that. So does Texas, for crying out loud. I mean, Texas has the highest dependency on wind of any state in the United States. That's why we got hit so hard in this freeze in February. We had our pants down, absolutely, just like Europe. So, you know, I don't expect the human race to get wise and start planning for the future, because we don't do that. But you're asking the question. That's why I'm concerned, because we got all the pieces we need here. But if we manage them as poorly as we are right now, we will learn how to fix this through trauma.
Okay, learn how to fix this through trauma. God, that's a great way to say it, although it's very sobering. All right, so here's, thank you. And here's where I'm going with this. Given those concerns, right? And at some point here, sure, maybe some person in their garage invents cold fusion and it gets brought to market faster than technology has ever been deployed. And we magically avoid this crunch that we're talking about. But I put the probability at that, at you know, somewhere many decimal points out beneath 1%.
And I agree.
And you agree. Okay. So we're in a world right now where you know, the central banks are really sort of driving all asset prices, for the most part, right, through their interest rate policy. And they've been suppressing interest rates at historic lows. And when I say historic lows, I just don't mean like the past couple of years. I mean like the past couple millennia lows. And, you know, one can argue whether they're going to have the ability to you know, move markets around with that policy for as long as they want to going forward. But right now they're able to do it. And my question is if we're entering an era where we're still going to be very dependent on fossil fuels, but their supply, their true supply, their economic supply is going to become more and more important or a factor. To me, that seems like it's going to put a upward pressure over the next bunch of years on fossil energy prices, and that may become more important than the Fed funds rate. In other words, you know, sustainably rising energy prices that can't be magically whipsawed around the way that the Fed can do with interest rates, that may be a limiter on economic growth that the Fed is really powerless to overcome. Because as much as they would like to, there's no amount of trillions they could print up tomorrow that's going to invent another barrel of oil, right? These are real geological constraints that we're dealing with. So somebody, I think it was Jim Poplava, said this like 10 plus years ago when we had the oil scares, when oil was up, you know, near 140 bucks a barrel, but he had predicted that oil was going to become the next Fed funds rate. Do you share that overview that energy prices could basically supplant the Fed interest rate as really what drives economies going forward?
Wow. So I'm not an economist, as you know, but I wanted to say I like what you're saying only because I agree that it makes sense. I don't like what you're saying because it's scary. but what I think I'm qualified to say is that if a central bank, if its goal is to keep interest rates low, it can only do that if energy prices cooperate. And throughout since 2014, early 2015, until, you know, very recently, energy prices have cooperated. Energy prices have been, you know, kind of at their long-term average, which is, you know, like $45 or $55 a barrel in today's money. And so now we're pushing several tens of percent more than that. And to your point, I don't think there's any amount of money the Fed or other central banks can print that can change what is going to happen to the economy with sustained higher energy prices. I just don't think they can do it. There may be some new special technique, you know, something that we haven't thought about, the buying and selling of some derivative, but I don't think so. I just don't think there's any way that you can keep inflation from going up, and at some point interest rates have to follow no matter what we want to do. So that I think will have catastrophic effects. I mean, the part of the reason that we're keeping these super low interest rates is, I mean, you know, maybe it's good for the economy, it's good for consumers, but it's good for the government. I mean, if they had to pay anything approaching normal interest rates on the government debt, I mean, all governments would be absolutely hosed right now.
I think it's increasingly essential for the government to keep interest rates low. And this inexorable rise in energy prices is one of the daggers that may get them in the heart that they just can't avoid. All right. Well, great. Well, look, I want to try to wrap things up here. Thanks for giving us so much of your time, Art. I'm going to try to get through a couple big questions quickly, and hopefully we can have you back on in the future to dive into those in more depth and maybe some other big questions I'm sure folks are going to ask in the comment section here. But one thing you mentioned is look, it's not all doom and gloom. You know, we're not going to zero tomorrow. You mentioned that we're not running out of a lot of these fossil fuels, at least not tomorrow. I'm going to put up a slide here that you've shared that shows, especially with coal, you know, we got a lot of years left at current consumption rates. Not that we shouldn't be good stewards of it, but again, it's not like we're going to run out this winter. So, you know, you made a comment that really what's at the heart of the current crunch that we're feeling is really mismanagement, right? It's poor management of some countries' transitions away from fossil fuels. It's poor management of just how we structure the global supply chain system. Yeah, it's very efficient, but it's highly unresilient. So let me ask you this. What are your thoughts about nuclear energy? You know, it's highly demonized and perhaps for very good reasons for, you know, the Fukushimas and Chernobyls of the world. But do you see it playing a role in, you know, an intelligent role in the global energy mix? And how valuable of a tool could it be to get us through the long transition period from fossil to non-fossil fuels?
Yeah, I hate to say this. I'm really negative on nuclear, and it's not because I'm personally against it. It's just that I think the public voted with its feet about 30 years ago on nuclear, and I get well-intentioned questions many times a week on Twitter and elsewhere from people, you know, don't you just think that nuclear is the way to go? And the answer is no, I absolutely don't, because you can't overcome the court of public opinion just because it makes sense. And I'm not sure it makes sense, but let's just say it does. And let's just say that all of a sudden everybody agreed with these enthusiasts about it, which they won't. But do we have the wherewithal? Do we have the capital? Do we have the appetite for building the number of nuclear plants every year that we would need to make a difference? And the answer, I suspect, is a huge no. And so we take a look at a country like France, which is the most nuclear of any of the OECD countries. They have an aging fleet, if you want to call it that. Does anybody hear about France entering into new projects to build more nuclear plants to replace the old ones? I don't hear about that. Why not? What is that telling us? It's telling us something. Nuclear plants are hugely expensive. We have no idea what to do with the waste, the spent fuel rods. I mean, nuclear has just a mountain of problems behind it. But back to my point, even if you put them all away, I just don't think you can get there fast enough to make it meaningful. I know I'm going to get all sorts of pushback from, you know, the nuclear enthusiasts, but that's my view.
Okay. Well, look, I appreciate you shooting so straight from your perspective there. And it is interesting. I mean, there, I think right now it's probably one of the more heated debates going on right now around energy, because, you know, some of the things that you talk about of our current challenges in trying to get off of fossil fuels are the dependability, right? Are the affordability, et cetera. And that's one thing that nuclear can offer is, you know, predictable both financially and supply wise. Power right now, it comes with the other risks that you just mentioned there. So, but anyways, I'm collecting lots of experts perspective on it, and I appreciate you being so direct about yours. All right, so at the end of the day here at Wealthion, we do try to bring it all back to how people can build wealth going forward. And we talked a little bit about what you think is going to happen with prices in the near term as things maybe equilibrate more from today's more panicked state. But as you look forward for, let's say the next couple of years, are there opportunities that you see in energy markets that the individual investor would do well to consider? And that's either maybe investing in the prices of specific commodities, or maybe it's in some of the sectors that produce, these energy fuels. Do you have any advice or guidance or ideas to offer to the individual investor who's looking at the energy space and saying, "Hey, look, it's proving to itself right. It's proving to the world right now how important it is. You know, maybe there's a way for me to invest in this and ride that importance over time."
Well, my first advice is, be careful. As with all investments, things that look like a no-brainer, you can lose a lot of money on. But having said that, if you would have bought just some stock of some of the top names in E&P companies, exploration and production companies in the U.S. at the end of 2016, and just held them until the end of 2018, you would have made like 250%. I mean, just on average, in terms of the share price appreciation. And if you look at things like the S&P indices, and you look at their oil and gas production index, I mean, year to date, the E&P production index is up 116%. I mean, surely there is a way to make money by playing the stock. I mean, now commodities, I think, are, you want to start, buying and selling, oil and natural gas futures. I mean, I think you really need to have some experienced help on something like that. But to me, the simplest way to make money off of this energy boom is pick a handful of good companies, and it won't take a savvy guy more than about 15 minutes to figure out who the top two or three are in the oil and natural gas and coal sectors, and just, buy and sell their stock and, ride the cycles. I mean, I think that's the safest way to go. EFTs are perhaps a more conservative way. They also don't typically perform as well, but that's my simple advice. But I think that what I hope comes out of this crisis is that investors, and I'm talking about big investors, funds, I hope that they reevaluate their shorting of oil. Now, they've got a good reason for it, and that is returns. I mean, these companies have, had crappy returns for, the last 5 or 10 years. But if you believe that we're going to stick around at $70 or $80 a barrel, just use the benchmark of 50 or 55, they say they're making money at, it ought to be an attractive investment for somebody. And that will go a long way towards fixing some of these problems in our mad rush to the energy transition. I think we just need to slow down. Now, having said that, I don't think it's going to happen, but that would be the right outcome.
And if only everybody just listened to Art Berman.
If only everybody just made rational decisions, right?
Exactly.
Human behavior, though.
Art, I can't thank you enough for sharing so much of your insight with us in such a short hour here. Thank you so much. We'll wrap things up now, but very much look forward to having you back on the program again. We'll probably do that around the turn of the year because, whether things are beginning to moderate like you expect or whether things are getting worse, there'll be plenty to talk about that. And I'm sure just as many questions amongst our audience as we had leading up to today's video. So very quickly, folks, I mentioned at the beginning of the video that Art has very generously made one of his newsletters available to us for free. I'm going to tell you how to get that in just a second. But Art, let me ask the last question I always ask here, which is for folks that have enjoyed listening to you in this video and they'd like to follow you and your work going forward, Where can they go?
Well, there's two places. They can go to artberman.com, which is my website, and I have plenty of stuff for free there. But I also have some sort of subscription services, the newsletter being the principal one. I also do a weekly oil and gas report. I'm on Twitter. That's absolutely free at AEBerman12. It's kind of a fire hose of information that may be difficult to, you know, to process, but an awful lot of stuff in the way of graphs and opinions goes out there every day.
It's kind of like a free graduate course in understanding the energy markets. So Art, when you're mentioning those sources, I'll put the URLs up on the screen during the editing process. So like I said, Art has very generously made his most recent newsletter available to this viewing audience. So if you want to watch, if you want to get your hands on that for free right now, simply just go to wealthion.com/Berman. All right. And as we wrap up here, if you want to see other great guests like Art, the best way to support this channel's ability to do that is just to click the like button and then hit the red subscribe button below if you haven't already, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And if you want to find out who we're going to have on as future guests on this program or suggest ones that you'd like to see, just follow me on Twitter at Menlo Bear. I really do listen to every single suggestion that this community makes there. All right. And in terms of wrapping things up here, Art, again, thanks so much for making that report available. Folks, go get it now at wealthion.com/Berman. Art, look forward to seeing you again soon. Everybody else, thanks for watching.
Thanks, Adam.